Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. And just at the top, a little bit of a warning. I recently was talking with a listener, and I didn't realize I had so many young listeners, children actually listening with their parents, which is wonderful, but that also makes me feel compelled to give you a warning that this topic might not necessarily be suited for younger ones. In fact, there's going to be a lot of graphic discussion about sex and sexual acts, because that, for the Egyptians, is how they saw creation. If you couldn't have guessed that from the title of this episode, which I'm calling Magic and Masturbation, the Heliopolitan Cosmogony, there's just a little extra warning for you. Ancient Egypt, when it comes to their creation myths, has a lot of fascinating things going on. And the reason I called this episode the Heliopolitan Cosmogony is because I didn't want to give the impression that there was just one creation myth. It's actually, for me, one of the most fascinating things about ancient Egypt. That every cult site in ancient Egypt, each major temple, was thought to be the site of creation. They had their own different creation myth that could involve different gods and had a different story. And the important thing to remember about all of these myths is that myths we tend to think of today as just entertaining stories, as things which in some ways are humorous, but they're not just entertainment. In fact, a myth is something that's actually a reflection on the human world. Yes, the actors are usually gods or mythic heroes, and it takes place in a time outside of normal human time, but it's meant to shed light on the present. It's meant to provide some sort of perspective. Think about those myths where the ancients are describing how the seasons came about, or why the sun disappears at a certain time and the days become shorter because of the winter solstice. These are all things that are covered in different myths. And I don't want to go into those different myths too much, because we've got a lot on our plate just with creation myths. And even though there's this multiplicity of creation myths, they're actually all based on a common set of principles. And for the Egyptians, that was, at its basic level, creation was about order emerging from chaos. It was about a time when nothing existed. So for the ancient Egyptians, the time of pre-creation was this vast, chaotic, watery expanse called the Nun. And the Nun was infinite, inert water, nothing lived there, and eventually a god comes into being. We then see that those gods, or God, goes on to create other gods, and eventually the entire cosmos comes out of that. Well, how did this look? How did this happen, and why did the Egyptians choose this view, the idea of watery, chaotic nothingness, then giving way to life? Well, for the ancient Egyptians, this came about because they saw this happen every year. The Egyptians were always drawing from nature. They were looking at certain animals. They were looking at certain natural phenomenon. And they were then saying, oh, this principle at work here in nature can be elevated to a cosmic level. So what we see is that the Egyptians knew, for them, life depended on the Nile. They couldn't live without the inundation and the rich, fertile soil and the water that came with the annual flood of the Nile. But that flood wasn't something that could really be controlled. It was something that came, as they thought, on divine command. If the flood was too great, it led to destruction. If it was too small, it led to famine. What they saw was water that carried with it potential for life. Because as that water would recede, they would see bits of land appearing. And on that bits of land, they would see frogs and snakes, and those animals become associated with the early time of creation. But that first spot where the waters receded from, that's an ancient Egyptian called the Septepi, or the first occasion. That is thought to be the moment of creation where we first have an element coming out of that primordial noon. Again, they're looking at nature and drawing this parallel from their everyday life and thinking, this is what must have happened on a cosmic level. We have the cosmic infinite noon that then receded, or we had land rise out of it, and that is where the gods then created themselves. And in fact, that spot of creation, that first occasion, that's actually seen as being the spot then where temples are built off of. So each major center would have their own creation account, and that first occasion was said to be the shrine where the god would then have their divine statue. And then the idea being that creation kind of spread from there. So, as I said, I don't want to get into all the different creation myths, because I think that's just a lot. But I'll focus on the main one. And the main one is the Heliopolitan cosmogony. Heliopolitan, meaning from the city of Heliopolis, the city of the sun. Of course, that's not what the Egyptians called it. The Egyptians called it Yunu, and that was the city of Re, what's under modern-day Cairo. And in this myth, we have those same features. We have a vast, inert, lifeless body of water, the noon, and it's completely dark. There's no land, and a god brings himself into being. Now, the way in which he brings himself into being is kind of why we had to give a little bit of a warning to children at the beginning. According to the Heliopolitan cosmogony, we have Atum, or Atum Re, sometimes we'll see it syncretized, as our main creator god. And that's actually very interesting, because the root we think for his name, Tem, can mean to not be, or it can also mean to be complete. So within his name, we see this creator function, and this god has kind of male and female elements. And the god is said to be existing in solitude in the noon. And then, as though this god were perhaps a teenage boy filled on hormones, he does one of two things depending on how you interpret the text. He either masturbates, or he engages in an act of autofellatio. And the reason I say the text isn't unclear is because in some cases, it actually says, grasps his phallus in his hand, and he makes the divine fluid. And very interestingly, hand in Egyptian is a feminine word. But for those of you who are more familiar with ancient Egypt, you'll know that there's actually a specific title that becomes associated with this later on, the god's hand of Amun. The Amun cosmogony is very similar to the Heliopolitan, and we actually have a royal title of a priestess who is actually meant to serve as the god's hand, to help enliven the god's sexual energy in order to help him to create himself. Because one of the things the Egyptians believed is that creation was a cycle that needed to be kept going. So back to our story. So our god's either masturbated or he's going down on himself. And the other texts that talk about him going down on himself simply say, and then the divine fluid entered into his mouth. And it's really interesting. I was at a conference last year and someone was talking about this, and another scholar stood up and said, you know, everybody talks about this and the text, you know, never says that he actually puts his penis in his mouth. And the person presenting laughed and said, okay, well, how do you think the fluid then got into his mouth? It was quite a funny moment. I think everybody who was present at that exchange enjoyed it quite a bit, but I digress. So this fluid gets into the god's mouth. And the interesting thing about ancient Egypt compared to many other cultures is, one, the procreative power was thought to live with the man. Men were seen as the ones who had the ability to create life. Women served as the nurturing vessel for that seed, but it was the men who had the power to plant that seed. So fertility was considered to be a problem of men. And in this case, we can see that it's that potential that allows a God to bring himself into being through his act of self-pleasure. And then as the fluid, his semen, gets into his mouth, he spits it out. And that spitting out creates a pair of gods. It creates a god Shu, and it creates a god Tefnut. And those names are very interesting because there's very clearly some wordplay there. So Shu, who's the god of, we might think of him as a god of dry air, a god of the wind. We actually see in the text, it says that he spit out, or in Egyptian, Ishesh Shu. So you can already see that wordplay, Ishesh Shu. He spit out Shu, and then he coughs up Tefnut. Tefnut being more of a maybe moister, corrosive air. She's a goddess. We don't know too much about her. And the word for cough in ancient Egypt is Tefen, or at least as it appears here. So the god Tefen, Tefnut, and Ishesh Shu. And the Egyptians loved this type of wordplay and punning, and they felt that words that sounded alike were often connected. So he creates these two gods. And of course, what happens? We've got a male and a female god. Well, those gods, of course, are going to have sex. So those gods we can see of as being space. So the god has created himself in these vast inert waters. He then creates this space of these two air-type elements of Shu and Tefnut. They have sex, and they go on to then produce two children, Geb and Nut. Geb is the god of the earth. Nut is the goddess of the sky. And I'll put images of this up in the cover art, but this is one of the common images you'll see of a woman spread out over a man. That's Nut, spread out over Geb, the god of the earth. Again, another interesting thing that Geb, the earth god, as opposed to most cultures where it's a mother goddess, Geb, again, a male god. And of course, those two gods go on to have sex, and they actually have four children. They have Osiris and Isis, and Seth and Nephthys. So two boys and two girls. And this is really where trouble starts for the world. Everything is going fine when we had Atum and Shu and Geb. The earth has been created. The cosmos has been created. And the kingship, as the Egyptian texts tell us, has passed from Atum to Shu to Geb. Well, now we have a bit of a problem because Geb has two sons. So he gives the kingship to Osiris, as most of us know. But this creates a problem because we see that Seth becomes extremely jealous. Seth wants the kingship for himself. So he's kind of the archetype in ancient Egyptian myth for a rival. And he's one of the earliest gods that we see. He goes back very, very far. Well, depending on how the story goes, and I'll just give an abbreviated version here, because at some time I'm going to do the full myth of Osiris, where we'll actually get into Plutarch and some of the different versions. But basically what ends up happening is Seth sets a trap. And in that trap, he murders his brother Osiris. He dismembers him, and he scatters his corpse throughout ancient Egypt. And this scattering of the corpses is actually meaningful, because the different parts of Osiris's body become linked with different cult sites. And there's actually a festival in ancient Egypt where they would collect all those body parts, or at least what was meant to represent those body parts, from all over Egypt, and they would bring them together to form a little mummy made out of dirt that had seeds in it. And that mummy was then thought to be a form of Osiris, and as it would sprout some of those seeds, it would then be a way of helping to ensure new life. And that was part of a festival called the Hoyak Festival. So Osiris's body has been scattered. Isis is very sad at this. So she searches for the body parts of Osiris. She's able to find everything but his penis. Now, the god needs a penis. We've been talking all about the creative power of gods. Well, that extends into the funerary aspect as well, and we'll see that why in a second. Now, luckily for Isis, she's a great magician. So she magically creates a new penis for Osiris. And of course, what does she need to do then? Well, she needs to figure out how that penis works. So she then has sex with Osiris. This results in two things. It helps to revivify Osiris. He's brought back to life. Through this creative act and through his fertility, he's able to come back to life and to be reborn. Isis, on the other hand, gets pregnant. And this creates a problem because Osiris, while he's been reborn, is not allowed to leave the netherworld. He's trapped in the netherworld and he can't come back to this plane of earth. So at this point, Seth is actually ruling over the world. Isis knows that if Seth finds out she's pregnant, Seth is going to maybe kill her, definitely kill the child. So she goes into hiding. And usually this is talked about as happening in the Delta. So Horus is raised in the Delta, that marshy region, in secret to protect him. And when he comes of age, he then goes and he challenges his uncle Seth for the rule of the two lands. I won't go into too much detail here. I've got a whole podcast on the myth of Horus and Seth, so you can actually go back to that, and that'll be able to break down that story into more detail. The end of that story, at least the main version that we have, ends with Horus gaining control of the two lands. He's the king of Egypt. Seth is put at the prow of the bark of Re, and he's going to use his fierce destructive powers to fight Apophis on behalf of the sun god every day. So he'll actually travel with the sun god. And the sun god, which is thought to be die and to be reborn every day, is actually another great example of how these kind of myths become linked, because part of the solar journey through the netherworld isn't just the fighting of Apophis, it's actually joining with Osiris. So as the sun god goes through the hours of night, in the sixth hour, and there were thought by the ancient Egyptians to be 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night. So in the sixth hour of night, the deepest, darkest part, the sun god, his Ba or his soul, actually joins with the corpse of Osiris. And by joining with Osiris, the sun god gains access to Osiris's regenerative powers and is able to be reborn. Then, as he's weak and he moves into the seventh hour of night, he's attacked by Apophis. Apophis being a snake associated with chaos. So that primordial element of chaos is attempting to reconquer the order, to kill the sun god. And it's Seth who uses his destructive power and his strength to help spear Apophis. And we also see in these images that Isis also appears to help, although Seth is really the main protagonist in the destruction of Apophis. Well, after Apophis is defeated, it's kind of all downhill from there. And then they go to the end of the night cycle. The Ba of the sun god leaves the corpse of Osiris. Osiris is left behind in the afterworld, and the sun god is reborn again as the god Khepri. So this myth, this Heliopolitan creation myth, lays out the entire Egyptian system. We already talked about how they drew their inspiration from nature in terms of observing a natural phenomenon and then weaving a myth around it that incorporated those principles. But this myth, more importantly, also explains kingship. It explains the orderly succession, that it's not only the strong who's meant to rule, because Seth is clearly stronger than Horus. He's maybe not that smart, but Seth is definitely strong. But there's meant to be the rightful passage of authority from father to son. That is how the Egyptian system is ordered. Now, each pharaoh who comes on is then a manifestation of Horus. They're thought to be another manifestation of Horus who exists in the office of the pharaoh. And in fact, we have something called the royal ka. And your ka is something like a spirit or a life force. And there's a divine life force that comes with the office of kingship. And that's part of what helps to make the king divine. Now, I promised you not just masturbation, but also magic in terms of this creation myth. And one of the things that we see is that as the god is creating himself, he's said to be supported by two different twin elements or twin pillars. One of these is Ma'at, and Ma'at is the Egyptian word for cosmic order or justice. So the god is supported by Ma'at, but he's also supported by Heka. And Heka is the Egyptian word for magic. And the interesting thing about magic that we have to keep in mind, and this is something I talked about in a previous podcast on magic and medicine, is that magic is just a cosmic force. It's neutral in meaning. It's not sacrilegious. It doesn't run counter to religion. It's a force that exists from the very beginning in ancient Egyptian myth, and it was practiced by everyone to a greater or lesser extent. We certainly had famous magicians, and we had ritual specialists who existed amongst priests, but we also have magic that appears to be practiced by more ordinary individuals. So it's not as though it's something that somehow was seen as impious. So there you have it, the Heliopolitan creation myth. This wonderful kind of tale about a god pleasing himself and how that brings the earth into being. Hopefully you all find this interesting. I think it's one of the most fascinating tales from ancient Egypt for a couple different reasons. It's not just fascinating because of the kind of sexual elements, but it's fascinating for the precedent that it sets, because we see that idea, as I mentioned earlier, that men are responsible for fertility, and that goes on to really show in many ways an overemphasis on male creation. And in fact, there are even some sort of arguments or debates as to whether women could really have an afterlife. Men needed that procreative sexual energy to help create themselves, like Osiris did and like Atum did. So what do women do? How do they interact with this system? Well, very clearly they believed that they would, because they build tombs, they have funerary monuments, they have funerary materials, but they don't necessarily have a good equivalent of a woman that they can connect themselves to. Eventually, in the later period, later Greco-Roman period, we'll see that Hathor becomes claimed, and we have a specific manifestation called Hathor of the West, and she becomes this figure that women associate themselves to. But we do see an interesting gender fluidity in some cases where women actually attempt to associate themselves with Osiris in the same way that men did, and in the same way that the sun god does to be reborn. So the idea of sexuality and sex being something that leads to creation and to birth affects Egypt from the very beginning of their society, at least in terms of their creation myths and how the earth was created, all the way through to their funerary monuments, where they needed to have sexual stimulation and the proper sexual organs in order to be reborn. There are different figures that we even see that are sometimes referred to as, you'll see, brides of the dead or female fertility figurines. Many of these we'll see buried in tombs, and some Egyptologists think that these are buried with the individual to help excite them sexually. And by exciting them sexually, that's going to help get those productive juices flowing and help them to be reborn just as though, just in the same way that we saw with Osiris. So we really have to talk about sex when we talk about ancient Egypt, because these ideas and sex really permeated all of society. It was something that in many ways you'll see excluded from certain textbooks, especially the older materials. We see that scholars writing, especially in the early 20th century, they're a bit prudish. You'll see some translations talking about the Heliopolitan cosmogony where it will say, one of my favorite, I won't name the author, actually says that the text is broken when it gets to the part about him having the semen in his mouth. When the text is not broken, they just were not that comfortable talking about that. Especially, you can imagine the strong history of British Egyptologists, no doubt, you know, some Victorian values seeping into the scholarship in a way that we wouldn't necessarily find acceptable today. So there we are for this time. You can now say you know a little bit about the Egyptian creation myths, about how the gods all came into being through a single act of either autofellatio or masturbation, and how it was through necrophilia that Osiris was reborn and individuals were able to gain access to the afterlife. Thank you for listening to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to it and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever format you listen to it on, if they allow that. If you have any questions or any feedback you'd like answered on the podcast, please, you can feel free to get in contact with me on ericsguidetoancientegypt.com, or also through our Facebook page, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, or on Twitter at Eric's Egypt. I also have an audience survey on my Twitter and Facebook pages, so if you'd like to give me any suggestions or feedback there, please feel free, and thanks for listening.